So it's a couple of minutes after 11, according to Mark's watch. We'll just get rolling. This is being recorded, this session, so when we have questions, I think there's a mic, a lot of mic up here. People will have to stop being the usual shy table and walk up to that mic. And then we'll just get going. So the session is From Oil and Gas to Clean and Fair, Restoring the Gulf of Mexico During the Climate, work on my book, Blue Frontier, and David Hobart, an SEJ member, author, etc. One, I was talking to the company man, whose name actually was Bubba. I said, Bubba, what happens if you get a blowout and I'll let you down? I said, well, Dave, I guess we'll find out when that happens. So 10 years later, I was flying a small plane over 100. Gulf of Mexico is known, depending on who you are, there's America's energy pollution and production effects from offshore oil and gas and the petrochemical complexes that have grown into cancer alleys around predominantly low-income communities of color along the coastline of the Gulf. And yet, we say nationally that we're in an energy flood. The image is that the Gulf of Mexico will also be part of this transition from fossil fuels to a different future, one that's supposed to be sustainable and equitable. So to address the reality of that, we have three panelists today. I'm going to be brief. You can look them up. They're all amazing folks. Mark Schlestein is a longtime SEJer and environmental reporter for the I'm sorry, at a certain point, you know, just the hardware gets like starts to clutter his office. Cynthia Sartow's founder and the executive director of issues of regional concerns at national level. She testified in front of Congress last year. She's a winner, full disclosure, of the Peter Benchley Ocean Awards that I used to co-host before and eventually. And won it in 2010. So she got up there and said, you know, and Hillary Grammatic, founder and director of CETA, the Communities in Power and Development Association in Port Arthur, Texas, where his battles against the petrochemical polluters of predominantly the African-American community of Port Arthur has won him a prestigious, you know, international Goldman Environmental Prize. And he continues with his work. And I'm just going to, like, have the last 15 minutes roll it up to you. So start with Mark.
So in 1996, the old Times Picayune that I used to work for before the News Times Picayune existed, we did a project, a year-long project, which we don't do anymore, of course, on fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico. And called Oceans of Trouble. And when we started doing reporting on that, we asked fisheries managers and fishers and state and national officials, so, you know, what is the future of fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico? And they all basically said the sanction under control, and we think that we're, you know, after the disaster of the overfishing of redfish in the early 80s, the dose of fall becomes black and redfish. We got to handle on it and stop things. So we think things are really great. And then we went back to them all and said, well, what happens if Louisiana keeps losing wetlands at its present rate, which back then was 100 minutes? And they said, oh, well, there won't be any fish. Commercial fish in the Gulf of Mexico that we were able to bring to our, that's a real problem. So we knew we had a reason to do the series that we were able to bring to it. For what we learned that was the result of oil and gas development because of different canals and navigation routes that would affect that allowed salt water to enter in the north. And things like that. By 1990, the state had gotten its act and a handful of money so that we can change the Coastal Wetlands Plain Protection and Restoration Act, which did exactly that and actually led to the creation of a state master plan that was for both coastal restoration and hurricane risk reduction. Now, risk reduction didn't happen, though, until after Hurricane Katrina really showed what the potential was for disaster. Is still in effect. It's updated every 6 years now. Equally divided between levees and strategically in front of levees. And money it controls on restoration and risk reduction, and it expects another $2.3 billion from Congress through the infrastructure bill and supplemental hurricane. The plan recognizes since the 1930s, but hopes to limit continued loss of wetlands and reverse losses in those locations that provide term-limited Democratic governor in 2020 created a climate initiatives task force. And earlier this year, that task force adopted by 2050 the same goal. And it's unlike most other states in that 66% of its greenhouse gases are created by oil and gas production, the petrochemical industry, and then another 10 to 12% by electric utilities. The state's on its way to having six active major LNG export facilities, each of which has been counted in that initial 2021 estimate the state came up with, which is 270 million. The state's plan recognizes that from every portion that you think of position, how do you move towards replacing heat sources for both free or carbon reduced or carbon capture processes, actually find ways of making products without disposing of it in some way. Actively managing methane emissions, which includes the state has under the infrastructure bill requested money to cap 6,900 orphan wells that are most of which are leaking methane, and then transportation development in the built environment, looking at ways of then other ways of using natural and working lands and wetlands for storing carbon, getting agriculture involved, and being adaptability to ensure lasting success. And at the table for this conference was everybody, oil and gas, the petrochemical industry. And they all agreed to do this plan, although obviously they also, especially oil and gas legislature, and by the Independent Public Service Commission in Louisiana, both of which Democratic governor who believes is one of those candidates does not believe in climate change, thinks it's a lie, and move on.
Wow, you 60%. Even if you reduce those emissions, it's like reducing gun violence at the coal firearms factory.
Yeah.
So let's.
The thing about both of the states' plans is that they are really pretty good plans. Although the master, everybody can get everything they want, essentially. They had plans for restoration, but it was like everybody would stay the same and everybody. It wasn't until, what, 7 or 8 years ago that they finally said, oh, guess what? There are some people that are going to be losers. They're not going to get anything. There are other people who are going to be winners. And to get the wins, we may be increasing your losses. So the master plan in many ways. So first and foremost, the state is still continuing. Any one incidents destroy 500 to 1,000 acres of wetlands. Many of them in the vicinity of these diversions, they're planning to restore wetlands. So, and in fact, in one instance, although the oil and gas industry was successfully barging their oil across this wetland area, this what will be the Moratorium diversion, and we had to fight to reduce the wetlands loss related to that pipeline. So there's this kind of serious inconsistency in the way the state is approaching this, and to protect wetlands, right? Less protection, but more restoration. But at the same time, it will not stop anything in terms of industrial development that may, in fact, undermine that master plan. which gets, I mean, even to the extent that there was a coal terminal proposed in Plaquemines Parish, which we defeated, and then it became an oil terminal. And in both instances, the state issued an MOU that said, oh, our scientists say that you may interfere with our diversion, and diversions are their way of big projects to restore wetlands, but we're going to reach an agreement with you that says that you promise us you won't do that, essentially. So there was this MOU, and it was like, but your scientists say, this is simply, no, they can do it so that it doesn't, and we've reached an agreement, so really you have no problem. Is there is a large diversion proposed, the Barataria diversion. We admit that it is critical on low-income Native American, African-American communities. And the state has no plan for mitigation. They have a non-structural plan, but they admit that this non-structural is totally reliant on parishes to do their own planning and to seek federal funding. In fact, at one point we were told, oh, well, we'll have to rely on FEMA post-disaster funding to implement this plan. So in other words, we're going to let people be impacted, and then we're going to try to find them the money to see if we can make them more resilient. And so what's starting to happen in Louisiana is that as we keep them there, so they're leaving with nothing, right? They are starting to, Bullard said, gentrification, climate gentrification is very real. And even in these coastal parishes, the wealthy are moving into the higher levels of those parishes. The poor cannot afford to move into the huge lately, but it's potentially going to get very large. I'll tell you after Iowa, one of the stories that I think started to be covered, I don't know how much it was covered, is that FEMA did a worse job than I've ever seen it do. The communities we work in couldn't get FEMA dollars. They couldn't get FEMA tarps on their own. I mean, I know FEMA said they responded, but my organization, we're so concerned about St. James, St. John, went and gut and tarp houses and go in and help those communities rebuild. So there are these serious issues that the master plan, which, like I said, I support, but it's a theoretical master plan, right? It hasn't built a wetland yet. Well, maybe it has. It built some of land, but it hasn't really addressed some of the issues that are come with it. And then we come to the climate plan, which nobody ever talks about this, but there was a huge blow up, sort of quiet. I forgot. Anyway, in sequestration, huge, because what's happened is we have this really good climate plan. But industry has decided that their way of addressing this is to go 100% throttle down on carbon capture and storage. And not only for existing facilities, but we have, you know, a new build out of oil and gas, which nobody seems to be covering much. We have new plastics plants. We have ones being built offshore of Grand Isle, which got battered by the last hurricane. We have oil ports. We have additional pipelines, and our governor has now invited significant reductions in discharges by industry. They're talking, forcing them to capture all their carbon and shove it into old oil and gas wells or salt caverns. Actually, I've heard Exxon's buying leases. This is what I heard, buying leases. They want to do business as usual and rely on carbon capture and storage, which, you know, I've talked to people, Mark and I were talking. There is carbon capture and storage, but the industry is saying they can do 95, 85, 75% of their carbon can be captured and deep well injected. Well, nobody's shown anybody in the Gulf that they can do more than 45%. So there's this total disconnect in industrial development reliant on carbon that nobody talks about is, guess where all those deep well injection is going to go? It's going into communities that are the disadvantaged community, fence line communities in those areas. They're not going to take it someplace else. They're actually going to use existing infrastructure in those low-income communities. And, so it's becoming very controversial. I mean, I'm sad because John Bell Edwards, our governor, was very well-meaning when he put it together. The other thing I will tell you, which is I have authority to regulate carbon capture and storage, right? Which would require you, I think, have a state legislator who has a bill in the legislature to ban the regulation of any greenhouse gas under any federal law without express permission of the state legislature, which in our state will never happen. So they're undermining their own greenhouse gas emissions. So our state, I think, is very confused and conflicted by climate change. Their outage that you can't continue, you can't do both at the same
time. Sid, thank you for that very hopeful presentation on the future of the Gulf and the transition.
Just to give you background, I've worked in the Gulf for 26 years, okay? So, like Hilton, we've seen the Gulf.
But Hilton, now we know that Texas is a much more progressive state than Louisiana, so you can tell me about how every little justice transition is going to happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, my name is Hilton Kelly, founder and director of the Community Empowered, that's IN-P, Port Arthur, Texas. Port Arthur, Texas is home to the largest oil refinery in the Northern Hemisphere, which is Motiva. Motiva puts out 633,000 barrels of oil per day. Next to Motiva, we have Valero. Next to Valero, we have Chevron Chemical. And down the road from them, we have Veolia Chemical Incineration Facility, which is a French-owned company, and they petitioned for chemical waste from all over the world to incinerate in the city of Port Arthur to add insult to injury. If we talk about the east end of town, then we're talking about Total Oil Refinery that's in that area, which is a French-owned company. We have BASF Chemical, which is a German-owned company. So we have a lot of multinational companies doing business right beside the American companies. And many of them are located in the moderate to low income people of color community, which is the historic ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil is also located right up against the waterway here. Who's impacted and how do we stop it? Okay, we got here number one because we know there was a huge oil boom in Spindletop back in 1901. It's like 13 miles north of Port Arthur, Texas. So, of Jim Crow, they were forced to live in those areas. The Emancipation Proclamation was free to go wherever you could find a place outside of areas where you were restricted from living, such as inner city and whatnot. So, therefore, we were forced to live. We were forced in West Port Arthur as well, right up against the marshes and lands. And right into Port Arthur, Texas, we were forced in West Port Arthur as well, right up against the marshes where you had lots of mosquitoes and other insects were, you know, this is why the land was considered uninhabitable, but we made something out of it. And well into the 1960s, we still were forced to live there due to Jim Crow laws, federal, state, and local laws. So many people ask the question, well, why don't you guys just move? Why don't you just get out of those dirty, infested, mosquito-infested areas and chemical overburdened communities? Well, number one, because we were forced to live there, great-grandmother owned that property. She passed it on to your grandmother passed it to mama, and mama passed it on to the present generation. And so now we live in an age to where the things are changing and climate change is starting to areas that are most heavily impacted. Why? Because as the water rises, we're losing those wetlands. Those wetlands are now no longer a barrier, so now the water is invading upon the land. I've seen huge chunks of land just fall off into the Sabine Lake. I remember going to McFadden Beach. McFadden Beach is just that beach back in 1960. The surf actually set about 25 yards away from the road. Now we're there in order to get to the beach now. So we are seeing sea level rise about 20 miles and then drop back down to the coast heading into to Galveston, Texas just to go to the beach, because that road is completely gone. Sea level rise is real, and cutting a pathway for the barges to be able to come in and out easily. They wanted a way all the way into Texas and then across Port Arthur, Texas, all the way into Galveston, Texas. Now, when we talk about the impact on the residents, once again, they lost land, but they don't have a voice. They didn't have a voice in the early 1900s. And well into the 1950s and 60s, people living in those wetland areas still didn't have a voice. But now the pollution has come into a situation to where we understand how it's impacted our body. Learned that, well, by breathing this stuff, it's killing you. Benzene is being dumped into the air, which is a known carcinogen. 1,3-butadiene is dumped into the air, which is also a known carcinogen. Sulfur dioxide, 1,3-butadiene is another known carcinogen. All these chemicals have died from cancer. 1 out of every 5 households have a child or someone in it in Port Arthur and Beaumont that has to use a nebulizer to breathe or take breathing treatments, you know, where you have the pump going and the child has to, you know, to sit there and inhale the butadol so that they can breathe. So we have some major issues with it. Well, it's a no-brainer for me. 8 acres of land per month right in the Port Arthur, Beaumont. And once they're displaced, where do they go? Do they move inland? That whole system would be disrupted. Now we have to abandon this land, so now we have to just leave our property. We have to start all over again and hear mom and pop and grandma fought all their life to keep their land. Who's going to pay for that? Who's going to finance their survival while they readjust to a new life to save our coastal area in the heartland? To find a way. So we have to look at ways in which to save our coastal areas. We have to find a way to reduce the carbon footprint. Then we're all going to pay the price. And that's why it's imperative that we find a way to save our coastal land and reverse the impacts of the oil and gas industries. Because clearly, it's more than just about what they dump into the air, just moving people around. But it's about the oil and gas industries are trying to do everything they could to get that pipeline all the way from that to come in. And we know it's a heavy crew. But yet they were having problems every step of the way. We need fresh water. Everyone, I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, whether you're for oil and gas or you're against it. Number one, you need fresh water to drink. We all need it. We need fresh air. We need clean land in which to grow food. And our kids, we live in those communities. Their bodies can't take it. Hell, adults can't take it. But our president of this particular... But now Biden came in and impacted. So we have to find a better way in which to produce the energy that we need. And I think cleaner energy such as solar and wind is the way to go because it's literally killing people. And if we really want to reverse the impacts of our coastal areas and want to be more resilient and regrow the land, stop the dredging. Dredging is a huge factor which contributes to land erosion. Also, when LNG ships come in, we have 2 LNG facilities in the Port Arthur area. One is called the Golden Pass LNG facility in Sabine. Sabine is a district to Port Arthur. And then there's the Cheniere LNG facility. How much is too much? So we have to put human health and the environment over the greed of these industries. So with that, I'll stop.
Okay, so let's have a little discussion here first. So we've got the war in Ukraine because 1970s. Now we've got empowered petrodictators in Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia. The idea of becomes a national security issue as well as a community equity issue. In the Gulf, how real are the gigawatts of this next wave? There's 2030. Most of that seems to be going into the East Coast, Eastern Seaboard. How much is happening here? It's also supposed to be the fabrication facility in the Gulf.
It's moving very slowly.
You want to go, Mark?
Sherry, Mike.
I'll let Mark go first.
Okay. So there are a couple of things that are happening. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management just gave an update to the state coastal protection of Russia's offshore for wind in 2020. That's a positive sign. Even as there are industries that are planning on using carbon sequestration, emission equal, so to speak, at the same time, there's also a pretty major effort by the state to create a hydrogen power sold to some of these industries as an alternative. So that's something that is in the works, and they've gotten some federal money for that. Once you get the leases offshore going, that could work. New Orleans also has at least one, I think maybe two, facilities that are building parts of wind energy process, and it has at least one of its major offshore oil companies that provide boat traffic and that sort of thing has created new boats that are specifically for wind. So there's an effort towards getting more electric vehicles has been rather slow to that. One of the problems in Louisiana is that one would think, well, one of the easy ways you could do that is with school buses. But unfortunately, in Louisiana, school buses are privately owned. So you're going to have to figure out a way of making it so that those private owners get part of that money. And then another thing going on, the buildings where Bud itself has a bunch of electric vehicles and is using it. But there's not really much of a network with local gas stations.
So, as Mark said, I mean, there's not a lot of action in Louisiana. The PSC has not passed a renewable fuel standard of any kind. There is some effort. My concern about the wind effort is that I've heard very little discussion of how they, in fact, are coordinating between wind leases and oil leases. The oil industry is continuing to, and I'm not quite sure how you lease the same block to two different people for two different.
They have specific areas that they have set aside. And if you go to the CPRA website, mm-hmm. you just do Louisiana CPRA and go to that to their need, it'll actually show a map of units. It's for Louisiana and Texas.
Well, that's good. That's good news. I mean, because our concern is, like I said, I mean, there's now a new LNG facility going out on the ocean. We have numerous platforms out there. We've been trying to figure out how they're going to coordinate. And BOEM wants to use that historic infrastructure as a way to I'm not quite sure they want to use it to run their, like, lines or something. Instead of pulling out the pipes, they want to use it to run. I haven't quite do this in an area trying to figure out what to do because, to be perfectly honest, BOEM has never had to do this in an area where there's significant oil.
What we're looking at is looking at those pipeline areas that are already set off from, you know, being limited what you can dredge and where you can dredge and things like that out in the Gulf and using facilities.
Okay, then I have a question for you. Are they removing the oil pipeline before they put that in?
That is probably not in the area.
Are there any actual green jobs in solar, offshore, onshore wind that are appearing or are there?
Well, what we have going on in Port Arthur at this particular time, I know the city of Port Arthur have invested heavily in electric buses. But those buses, in order to charge them, they have to be inside the station. So if those buses were to lose, it's to increase charging stations throughout the city of Port Arthur. I think it was certainly to get rid of the old ones or do some kind of conversion. That's what's happening now. But our organization actually is working closely with NREL, I believe it's called, NREL with solar projects in the city of Port Arthur. We have got some buy-in for their roofs, so local government and also a lot of business owners to put solar as well.
And also, I live in Richmond, California, which is a low-income, majority city of color with a 115-year-old Chevron, you know, closure. And the discussion if that's a discussion that's going on in Port Arthur or any of these.
Of the cost of fitting those solar panels on their home and purchasing them. This is one reason why we're starting with local businesses first to involve in the solar process as well.
And then someday those big monuments of petrochemical.
I like about solar and renewable energy opportunities is the fact that, you know, it's a new revenue source, it's a new job opportunity, and many people in the moderate to low income area closely have an advantage of it. But I think those oil and gas workers to be transitioned from oil and gas industry, because everybody's worried about, well, wait a minute, well, what would I do with my skills? So I think if we can address those issues, then we might have more buy-in from those industries and the workers as well, the unions.
And there's a lot to be done by those workers. I mean, we're in Louisiana, it's 1,000-something oil wells they're trying to close.
6,000.
Yeah. Oil wells they are trying to, orphan wells that they are trying to close. The state has actually taken financial responsibility for, and those oil workers would be. The wind energy, too, there has been production of turbines in Louisiana. There are a lot of shipbuilding facilities and others that people think might be a good source for that. I think the question for a lot of the area of the Gulf is whether, in fact, the low-income communities would benefit from that industry. And they still make those promises, but those are not the communities from which most of these workers come. And even post-BP and the restoration efforts, there was an effort to try to get local workers that they cannot, they have to take low bid, and that they cannot mandate that it be local or that, and I don't know if that's changed or if they have some mechanism to do it, but I do know there was a huge push across the Gulf to get local, especially African American low-income communities involved in that restoration effort, and it was not very successful.
That's one reason why the Biden administration, with the Green New Deal, has basically mandated that you have local leaders on the ground involved with moderate to low-income communities, because they're trying to put, if you get a federal grant for a solar project or a wind project, and give a voice to the community. So I'm hopeful that local governments will apply to that and stay true to that.
Let me ask one more question before we open it up to our folks here, which is we're already experiencing, intensified hurricane, storm surge. Theories of disaster should be, with opportunities to establish equity and lost capital and lost housing stock. Any of that happening yet? Any of that on the near horizon?
It's not like my field, but from what some of the climate justice activists I'm talking to is sort of what the communities, the low-income communities in African American, Native American communities are not as well politically connected. And many of them, I know there's Sandy Wynn in the coast of Louisiana, spent several years in issues. There were, all sorts of technical issues. There's a lot of expectation that you have easy access to computers, that you have. So I think it's a significant concern, a concern that, I continue to have, which is that the federal government and the state government presume it is very difficult to traverse a lot of these processes. And, I'm a college educator. And, I find it extremely difficult. If you don't have a computer and you're trying to go to the public library, it becomes, so as a result, the half.
We could take the politics out of the process, and the state, Louisiana, basically is a red state. And so we need to look at.
You mean politics is affecting our response?
Almost definitely.
I'll point out that Hurricane Katrina is a perfect example of everything that can go wrong in federal after the storm. Everybody basically said that the best way of getting things back to normal was to make sure that people could get back in their homes as quickly as possible. And but the state also was concerned that it had to make sure that its plan was designed in such a way that fraud didn't occur, because they were afraid that Congress would rip the money away from them. So they made the rules horrendously stringent and stupid, and it really caused problems. And then you add to that that there was another hurricane a month later that caused additional flooding in the Lower Ninth Fund community. You have a blood black mayor deciding that he was going to listen to the Corps of Engineers that was warning him that money for Terry's going to start tearing down homes in Lower Nine before people could even get back to their homes, before they were allowed back in their areas, which finally was stopped by a lawyer with Loyola and the university. And then the people who were able to get back, the FEMA city, well, the last place, you know, the electricity Entergy Corporation decided to declare the Entergy New Orleans bankrupt. So it single-handedly decided that that area was the worst damage for water and sewer. So it was the last place where people could get trailers. And by the FEMA had banned the use of those trailers because they were contaminated with formaldehyde. The way you could get money was that your home had to be worth not the FEMA process. Well, it's this community development block grant program. You could be eligible for up to $150,000 based on the value of your home before Katrina. Well, in those areas, the values of the homes were less than $75,000. And counted everything up, $50,000. So it was just horrendous. Everything, nothing was designed to say, hey, we need to recognize that this area is low income and they have real problems getting the money available to them to deal with their issues. FEMA now is attempting to.
But FEMA's fallen way short. I mean, more recent Harvey people have not been compensated for. I could take it to communities in Fort Arthur, Texas that knows like something from the Twilight Zone, because now FEMA has a patient proclamation being signed, and now you make money for ourselves to buy the bootstraps. So it's just like a, you know, what came first, a chicken or the egg? These guys systemically held us captive in the lying areas. And now that the sea levels are rising, I believe that state government, local government, federal government owe it to us. We're not asking for any a handout, but we're asking to be treated fairly. And the federal government owed that to the African Americans because that's where they put us. And even today, I was sitting in an agency meeting in that trailer, we were told that we had to start paying rent to FEMA.
Yep.
And it forced us to move into our home that was not even completed when it came to reconstruction of our home. But we went there and we just put plastics up to keep out the moisture from entering where we were sleeping. And not to mention the fact that in many of these meetings, your more affluent communities, and FEMA records shows this, that more affluent communities got 100% of what they asked for when it comes to repairing their homes, not once, but twice, when people living in the moderate to low income areas didn't even get 100% once. So there's definitely a disparity when it comes to fair treatment. How do we get people to come back home and make a whole again? Not in their homes from Hurricane Ike, Hurricane Harvey, and Hurricane Laura. Even though we were not totally devastated by Hurricane Laura and it went to Lake Charles, Louisiana, those folks are still devastated. So FEMA has a lot of work to do.
Right, and there are, you know, the interesting thing is there are models in New Jersey and elsewhere for how to make whole communities, low flood zone communities that have been impacted by these growing disasters, and we haven't scaled it up federally. 15 minutes. There's such a wealth of knowledge here that I won't keep asking. Ask the question first, do what I say, not what I just did, and make it a question for the panel. And here's the first question. Please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Nancy Averett, freelance environment. Were there...
One of the bigger projects...
So
one of the projects, one of the bigger projects is High Rivers and moving to allow it to capture sediment that's in that flow to move into Barataria Bay. As part of that process, during the time when it is open, and it won't be open year-round, but it will be open for maybe a couple of months, it will cause higher water in the bay and in some areas where there are communities. It will cause that water to be 1 to 2 feet above what it is, and or it's supposed to mitigate for that plan. But at the moment, it has $300 million for different kinds of mitigation. That includes mitigation for the environmental effects. What they're talking about is really, you know, elevating boardwalks to allow people access to their homes, but many of which are already elevated. So I'm assuming that the federal government is not going to allow them to do what she said, which is what they have been talking about, which is wait till the next storm. Minor problems. There are other major problems with that diversion that are still being dealt with, which is going to be very significant, which Congress has given the state a pass, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, mm-hmm. for takings. So,
oh, wow.
Which is,
yeah.
But they're still going to have to deal with it all that thing, with the dolphins.
Okay.
They don't consider it sacrificing them. They restoration, this is the critical, and they're not just critical to fisheries. I mean, these wetlands are storm protection for these communities,
yeah.
right? They are critical storm yes. protection for these, without the other. And I'm glad Mark just told me that it's only part-time, because the last iteration
is
blowing at some level the entire year.
It does, but it's just 5,000 cubic feet.
Serious challenge.
Yeah.
And as Hilton said, even in Louisiana, most of the people you find in the lowest lying areas are going to be those low income African American, Native American communities who were pushed into low areas as people started to develop in higher areas.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot get money for a low income community that will cannot relocate, or really, because their houses are not worth anything. And the conundrum, which I know Mark Davis at the Water Resources Law and Policy Institute at Tulane talks about, is it's going to get worse, because as insurance, like right now, we're getting told that most people in Louisiana are going to be paying at least 3 to 8, could be much higher, right? So most people are not going to carry flood insurance. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. So how much is their house worth then? When you can't get a mortgage on it, how much is your house worth then? And yet, if the federal government comes in on these programs, they're going to say, well, but your house isn't, you know, we don't see a value that we can give you. Well, so you're saying your house isn't valuable enough to allow us to help you move. You're just stuck where you are. And this is it's not just in our community. It's coming in Texas. It's coming in many places, because land is expensive if it's at higher elevations. But these people are not going to get the money to allow them to move to higher elevations.
Okay, and just become an incidental take becomes a massive.
Very clear, NOAA did not make that decision.
Congress
made that decision at the request of the Louisiana's.
We have time for one last question.
Okay.
Don't forget, we still have lots of handouts, and we have time for one last question from Steve Chappell.
Hi, Steve Chappell, Breakpoint Reckoning with America's Environmental Crises. And so my question is, like 20, 50 years out, do you think New Orleans and south of New Orleans run out of Houston as a population center, as opposed to an oil and gas navigation center, run out of Houston, something like that in Baton Rouge, and whether in between that time, whether the federal government, that is to say the taxpayers of the rest of America, will be willing to literally bail out New Orleans? That's kind of a doomsday way of looking at, but what do you think?
I'll start the response real quickly with what I normally say, which is that when Bienville and Iberville created New Orleans, they chose a location on the Mississippi River that was defensible. New Orleans called English Turn, because that's where the English ships would always be stopped. Most defensible against climate change. It is high enough up above the mouth of the river that a lot of that area below it might very well become just an island. It will become an island. That process is being changed right now by the expansion of levee systems. But it will be a levee area, and there will still be reasons for doing it. The cost of moving New Orleans, you have to deal with at least $200 billion worth of infrastructure alone, in terms of the federal government's going to charge to pay for that. And I don't see the localities dealing with it, but projects keep at least some of those wetlands in place.
And Hilton, give
great
me
answer.
Give me your image of like Port Arthur, the Texas coast, in 20 or 30 years, and be willing to be like vaguely hopeful.
You know, I do believe that any area that is chosen to be saved, that they put on the place and the amount of money they're willing to pour into a project. But we have to get started now with saving our communities, because the longer we wait, the worse off we're going to be. But I think any area is redeemable or savable, but yet at the same time, it's all about how much our government really want to put into it.
Tim, last quick statement.
No, I mean, I think, like Mark, coastal communities in along the Gulf of Mexico, unlike Miami and other places where they cannot wall it off and survive. So there are many more cities that are at greater risk of just washing away than is New Orleans. But it will require strategic. But I also agree with Hilton that my concern has been for a very long time that the federal government is disaster assistance or whatever, but they're not really coming up with plans and they're not really helping those communities, right? And in fact, sadly, one of my colleagues several years ago said, well, don't you think they should be investing only in the income generators, meaning the wealthy people who own businesses, right? And there is a lack of consistency in that some of those coastal parishes that have condemned property and moved people off of it are now concerned that it's not being developed and used for tax purposes. So they want to redevelop it. Well, what's the purpose? I mean, we just condemned it. So why are you going to be doing this? So I think, you know, the problem, as I see it, is that not just the federal government, but that people want to be the same way they are and don't want to expect that if you want to survive, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can do it. And that in fact, is not true for many communities because they have been so disadvantaged over the years through systemic racism, et cetera, that they are not in a place to be able to pull themselves up with those communities because they have a right to survive. And these are historic communities. I mean, maybe at some point sea level rise becomes too high, but to tell them they just have to move, like you just have to move.
I would like to say one other thing. You know, if we don't, it's imperative that we do something to help these coastal. Do you have the moderate, low-income people sleeping on the street? I've seen a large population of homeless folks increase in New Orleans, in Port Arthur, and all around us, here in Houston even. When you drive toward I-10, look under the underpass. Those are folks you have seen nothing yet when it comes.
Or is triage, saving what you can while you can, and maybe eco-restoration will keep SEJ active for a long time to come. There's a great resource pages that you should all pick up. And I'd like to thank this incredible